Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the fluoride deception when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And Swinton totally outraged his colleagues when he replied that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now you know it and I know it. And he said this in 1880. He said, there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with. And others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any one of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinion would be out on the street looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Now, the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, he said, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and then to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes, and we're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program, the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and the Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time we wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this new world order and this global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 Bible prophecy and this new world order, call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing, the fluoride deception, and we got up to the Manhattan Project. Now, remember, Dr. Phyllis Mullenix now has discovered the dirty little secret behind fluoride in a series of studies that she did up in Boston, Massachusetts, back in the late 80s and early 90s. She goes over to the NIH, that's the National Institute of Health, and she delivers a sermon to all of these paid professionals, you know, all the dentists and doctors and the FDA and the top brass echelon of our government. And she says, hey, guess what? Now, there was a guy there by the name of Hodge. Now, Hodge had died just recently. I shouldn't say he was there, but Hodge had actually done these experiments on the Manhattan Project during World War II with human guinea pigs. I mean, he wasn't dinking around with rats, you know. He was dinking around with real live people, and he was killing them back in World War II. And he knew of the neurotoxicity of fluoride, but he never let on because it was a secret. I mean, we're talking government secrets here. So fluoride in your drinking water traces back to the Manhattan Project, and it's top secret. By golly, it's top secret to this day. I mean, to this day. Now, we deceived the Germans, all right, and that was the top priority. And, you know, you need to look at General Groves, who was the General Leslie Groves now, who is the head of the Manhattan Project. He's got to have this fluoride. This fluorine is where they start, and then they turn it into fluoride, and then they use fluoride to make enriched uranium, which they then use to make atomic bombs. And this fluoride, this fluorine, is so important to the Manhattan Project that they've got to keep it secret. And there's not very much of this stuff in the world. I mean, this is an element. It's an unstable element. It's a toxin. It is so toxic. It is probably the world's most toxic poison. I mean, there might be something that might be a little bit more poison, you know, like plutonium maybe, or californium, or berkelium, or something that we've made. But not in the natural order of things. According to the author of the book here, fluoride is more toxic than arsenic and strychnine and 15 other poisons. It is so toxic that you got to have special licenses to handle this stuff. Ordinary poisons, you know, like Agent Orange and PCBs, I mean, the toxins that are polluting our environment. I mean, hell, any Mexican working in the lettuce field can handle that stuff. But this fluoride is so toxic, so dangerous, so bad. I mean, you got to be special just to handle this stuff. Now, in the early days, they didn't know what they were dealing with. There was so little of it, and it was so unknown, and they needed so much of it that they had a crash program to develop this fluoride. And so DuPont got into it, you know, the big chemical company back in Delaware. So they got in on the act, and Union Carbide and all these big corporations now during the war. Top secret. So it's top secret. And there's not much of it out there. What little bit is out there, they know it's poison. They know it's deadly toxin. They don't know how bad it is, but they know it's really bad stuff. So listen to the story. Exploiting this fluoride was a two-edged sword. As the bomb program scientists soon discovered, on January 20th, 1943, the senior Manhattan Project doctor, Captain Heimer L. Friedel, paid a visit to the sprawling New York campus of Columbia University, where a small-scale gaseous diffusion plant had already been built. Almost 1,000 researchers would eventually work on the bomb-related projects at Columbia's War Research Laboratory. After his visit, Captain Friedel warned of possible health problems. The primary potential sources of difficulty may be present in the handling of uranium compounds, as noted above, and the coincident use of fluorides, which are an integral part of the process. His warning was accurate. A fluoride gas release at Columbia later that year produced nausea, vomiting, and some mental confusion. In 1944, another researcher, Christian Spelton, developed pulmonary fibrosis after repeatedly fleeing clouds of uranium hexafluoride gas. Other health problems were also reported. Dr. Homer Priest, a leading Columbia University fluoride scientist, complained that his teeth seemed to be deteriorating rapidly. Dr. Priest told a doctor that he bled more freely and that there has been a progressive increase in the degree of slowness of healing of the pain in the period that he's been doing his work. And I'm going to underline this statement here. Dr. Homer Priest complained that his teeth seemed to be deteriorating rapidly. Okay? I noticed the same thing. I noticed that after I turned 50, that my teeth would just break off. Just pieces of them would break off, and I'd go to the dentist, you know, and he'd pull it out, and then pretty soon one would split down the middle. See, I'm suffering from fluoride poisoning just like you are and everybody else, especially here in the United States. Now, over in Europe and around the world, they have discontinued the use of fluoride in their drinking water. The United States is about the only country left that's still doing it. And we Americans have never awakened to the fact that this is a deadly toxin. And that, remember, the reason that they're giving this to us, it's for dental hygiene. It's for your teeth. It's to prevent all this dental problem. No, fluoride does not solve dental problems. It causes dental problems. Fluoride is the cause of your dental problems. Not your cavities, but the modeling of your teeth and the breaking off of your teeth and the splitting of your teeth, that's fluoride. I've got that problem, and so do millions of other people. Guess it's the greatest boon to dentistry since God put breath into a dentist. I mean, this has just got to be, you know, like this is like gold being showered on dentistry from heaven. So they can come along and say it prevents cavities. It's a natural element in the environment, and it prevents tooth decay. And there's some guys that actually believe that it does prevent tooth decay. And maybe it does. Hey, listen, the argument that it prevents your teeth from splitting in two, model teeth, and chips coming off of them is nonsense. That's what causes it. Now, there's more to the story. The epidemic spread. Princeton leaking fluoride gas left scientists feeling more easily fatigued. There were multiple reports of illness at Iowa State and of fluoride acid burns at Purdue, where two researchers were badly gassed with carbonyl fluoride in 1944. Health problems hit industry scientists, too. At DuPont, rather severe weakness was reported in 1943 by three scientists who had received heavy exposures to fluorine. The symptoms were ascribed by them to the oxyfluorides formed, a report said. Accounts of fluoride injury mushroomed as the laboratory work moved into full-scale industrial production. At Oak Ridge in September of 1944, 190 pounds of hexafluoride gas escaped into a room, drifted outdoors, and formed a chemical cloud 20 by 20 yards. Nine workers were exposed for periods of 20 seconds to 5 minutes, injuring the mouth, salivary glands, pharynx, skin, eyes, and lungs. And the news got worse. The same year, 1944, General Groves got shocking new reports of multiple deaths in the nuclear program. Details of those fatalities and fluoride's role have remained hidden, often for more than half a century. Now, the stories of the DuPont workers, who may have been fluoride's first wartime casualties, have not been made public until now, and they remain anonymous. Once secret military documents describing the deaths do not record their names. On January 15, 1944, a laboratory assistant, a chemist, and a girl technician producing the fluorinated plastic Teflon for the bomb program were exposed to waste gases. Now, remember this Teflon now. This Teflon. You ladies use this in your frying pans. At least they used to. I mean, they used to sell this stuff. I can remember buying this Teflon, and your eggs wouldn't stick to it. That's the very reason that they developed it, was because the uranium wouldn't stick to it. It was non-stick. It was a necessary ingredient developed by DuPont. And then after the war is over, then DuPont comes along and says, God, this stuff's really neat. Now, let's see if we can cook our eggs in it. Made from, guess what? Fluorine. All right, boys and girls, now you're drinking it in your water and you're cooking your eggs in it. And then... you develop a resistance to it. And as time progresses along, it's like sticking a little bit of cobra poison into your veins. And there's a guy down in Florida, he was a snake milker, you know, he milked snakes for a living. And he know every once in a while I get bit. So he tried an experiment. He put poison, snake poisons, you know, in little doses into his body. Now they're deadly poison too, but just a little bit. See? And pretty soon your body develops a resistance to it. Now, with this fluoride, it is a toxin that builds up over time. That is, it never dissipates out of your body. So it stores up and stores up and stores up. Then it gives you, as you build this resistance to it, see, it's storing it away in your body, and your body can tolerate this poison because it's coming in such small amounts. I mean, if you got a dose of it, it'd kill you. But if you take it in just parts per million, like this guy did down in Florida, after a while you develop a resistance to it. That's where Americans are. The whole American population has this resistance now to fluoride. But as it builds up and builds up, pretty soon you reach a toxic level by which it's going to kill you. But it doesn't kill you from fluoride poisoning. You die from something else. You develop symptoms, and then the doctor says, oh, my God, you've got Parkinson's disease. Oh, gosh, you've got multiple sclerosis. Oh, gee, you've got Alzheimer's. Oh, gosh, you've got this. And you feel real good because now we have a name for the symptom that you have. It ain't going to help you any because you're going to die from it. But you're not dying from fluoride. And that's the good news. You're dying from something else. Now, there's a way to get rid of this fluoride out of your body. There's a wild substance over here called activated charcoal. I'll just digress here for a moment and tell you about it. There was a guy in France when this was first discovered. This is about 1804, 5, 6, along in there, early part of the 19th century. And so this French chemist, he's looking for an antidote to poison. And then he gets to dinking around a little bit, and he discovers something called activated charcoal. Now, charcoal's been around for thousands of years. God himself, I guess, evidently discovered it or created it for our benefit. Anyway, the way it works is charcoal. Now, this isn't charcoal briquettes now. I'm talking about medical. I'm talking about activated charcoal, the stuff you buy in the drugstore. You can get it in cans. It's just dirt cheap. You buy it in cans. You put it in capsules. I like to take it in capsules because it's kind of gritty, you know, when you drink it. And I didn't like that so well, but I take it in capsules. But anyway, this chemist, he takes 3 grams. Now, 3 grams is a lot of arsenic. It's a god-awful bunch of arsenic. I don't know if he took it in one dose or several doses, but 3 grams of arsenic. Followed by massive doses of activated charcoal. Now, I don't know how much a massive dose is. It doesn't tell us whether it's an ounce, 2 ounces, a pound. I don't know how much activated charcoal, but the story said massive amounts of activated charcoal with no ill effect. So he took all of this arsenic, enough to kill elephants and horses, and he does this in public, and he says, now let me show you the antidote to arsenic. Now, they actually use this in the manufacture of Jack Daniel's whiskey. If you want to know why Jack Daniel's is such a mellow sipping whiskey, they filter all of it through activated charcoal. So that's just a little sideline over there. If you want to know how your whiskey is made, they charcoal filter it. And this charcoal absorbs 60,000 times its own weight in toxins. So, you know, this is a well-guarded secret. My boy got, one time he got bit by a copperhead, you know, and so we gave him charcoal. And we took him down to the hospital, you know, and look at him. So the nurse down there, she said, well, what have you done so far? My wife said, well, we gave him activated charcoal. And the nurse said, well, that'll take care of it. The nurse knew that activated charcoal would take care of that snake bite. They didn't need any anti-venom or anything else. The next day, now his arm, when he came back here to the farm from the hospital, his arm was as big as my thigh. I mean, it was the most god-awful thing I think I've ever seen. His hand was so swollen, it was about 2 or 3 times its normal thickness. It was so swollen and so thick that his fingers would not bend. That's how swollen it was from that snake bite. Now, he got bit about 10 o'clock in the morning, and at 10 o'clock the following morning, 24 hours later, after taking the activated charcoal internally and putting it on topically, he was back on the typewriter typing. No ill effects. Now, that's what activated charcoal will do. Now, it'll do it for snake bite. It'll do it for fluoride. It'll do it for anything. You know, if you get poison, activated charcoal is the answer. Now, doctors don't use that and they don't talk about it because it's cheap and it's effective. And there's no money in it. Now, the money is in treatment, not in cure. Always remember that. The money is in treatment, not in cure. So if you've got toxins, you know, building up in your body and you want to get those toxins out, you get on a regimen of activated charcoal. And the charcoal will absorb those toxins, just like it does out of the whiskey. You know, they're filtering this whiskey through. The charcoal absorbs all those toxins that are in the whiskey. And the whiskey goes through, but the toxins are held in the activated charcoal, and they throw it out. So there's a little lesson there for you about poison. Now, getting back here to January 15th, 1944, a laboratory assistant, a chemist, and a girl technician producing the fluoridated plastic Teflon for the bomb program were exposed to waste gases. Shortness of breath followed 12 hours later, and by the end of 36 hours, all three were in hospital. Colonel Warren was informed. The chemist recovered, but the other two died terrible deaths, turning purple and unable to breathe. When the 23-year-old female expired at the end of 10 days, her autopsied lungs resembled a victim of World War I poison gas attack. Colonel Warren's deputy, Captain John L. Ferry, suspected that the DuPont fumes contained certain oxyfluorides and suggested the military investigate the possibilities of this material being used as a poisonous gas. God, leave it to a general. Huh? Hey, listen, you see them people get killed by this new stuff over there? God, that's really great. Let's go out here and make some of it and see if we can't use it for poison gas. Maybe we can kill more people with it. I mean, after all, soldiers are paid professional killers, so I guess, you know, any way you can kill people, that's what you want to do. Now, although the Army ordered up fresh toxicity studies, fearing similar compounds may be formed in some of the other fluoride manufacturing operations, DuPont dragged its feet. Investigators suggested perhaps seeking to protect Teflon's post-war commercial potential. The manufacturer considers that we're buying a packaged product and is not interested in our investigating the toxicity of the materials involved, reported Captain Ferry. Now, several of the components thus far identified give good promise for commercial uses other than that contemplated here, explained a second Army official. Subsequently, there were additional reports of sickness associated with Teflon. British scientists visiting a DuPont factory just after the war confirmed that heated Teflon fumes were linked with excessive weakness, tiredness, nausea, and sore throat. And this is what we use to cook our eggs with, because they don't stick. Because that's the unique quality of Teflon that was used in the bomb program. In other words, it was used for that filtering process in the machinery that they were filtering the uranium through. Remember, this fluoride over here now is an unstable atom. It's a god awful toxic poison. It's a maverick, and that's why nobody was using it, because, you know, it was so difficult to use, too difficult, and so they learned how to use it. And boy, it's been used in industry ever since. I mean, I showed you this a couple days ago that fluorine is vital in a number of industrial applications, like making aluminum, making uranium, enriched bombs, all kinds of things. And then there's side things that come from it. And these side things that come from it naturally, you know, if there's something that we can use, we can sell. And DuPont doesn't care whether this Teflon kills people or not. And the key thing is, it doesn't kill you right away. Now, if it kills you over 20 or 30 years, that's not our problem. Your eggs didn't stick. But if it kills you in over 20 or 30 years and you die from some kind of a disease, a side effect, it's kind of like AIDS. You know, very few people ever die from AIDS or AIDS dementia. They die from some opportunistic disease way beforehand. So now, in America, we're able to report that AIDS-related diseases. That is, let me back up. AIDS deaths are very rare. It's the AIDS-related diseases that are killing the AIDS victims. And their death certificates don't say this guy died from AIDS. It says he died from pneumonia. So, you know, the guy's dying from flu, he's dying from pneumonia. His body was weakened by the AIDS. And then he died from some other opportunistic disease, and then his death certificate says, oh, gosh, this guy didn't die from AIDS, he died from pneumonia. And so they write that down. Hey, boys and girls, when you die from fluoride poisoning, your death certificate isn't going to say you died from fluoride. It's going to say you died from some other disease. That's what the bottom line is. Now, when I was a kid, people used to die from natural causes. In fact, when you read the obituaries in 1950, it would have said, well, old Agnes died of natural causes. Old Don or Joe, he died of natural causes. Now, if he got killed in a car wreck, oh, he was killed in an automobile accident. If he died from pneumonia, oh, he died from pneumonia. They'd list it. Today, nobody dies from natural causes. Everybody dies from something. I mean, you've got cancer, you've got stroke, you've got pneumonia, you've got, you know, there's something there when they do the autopsy and they come back and they put a label on that. And you died from something. Well, that ought to tell you quite a bit about our environment and about our society today. I mean, it used to be that you could get born and you could live your life and you could die from natural causes, everything natural. Today, when you're born, you get cancer a couple of times in your lifetime. You've been cured. Then finally, the cancer gets you and you die from cancer at age 57 or, you know, 65. Tuck that one away in your heart. Now, there's a Philadelphia story comes in here. The secret deaths continued. And Arnold Kramish is tormented by injuries sustained in perhaps the worst fluoride accident of World War II. Sitting in a New York hotel eating breakfast in October of 2001, with pastry crumbs sprinkling his shirt, Kramish described how he still endures painful fluoride skin eruptions on his legs 57 years after surviving an explosion that killed two of his colleagues. In the 1970s, he sought medical help for the recurring sores. A Navy doctor explained to him that fluoride stalks you for the rest of your life. Fluoride poisoning stalks you for the rest of your life. Now, you can get rid of that fluoride poisoning. This guy, had he used activated charcoal, he could have cleared his body out of that fluoride. He didn't know, and so he didn't do it. Now, the best solution is don't ingest it. But boys and girls, most of you people out there are probably bathing in it, for crying out loud. I mean, it's right there in your shower water, you know, when you get up in the morning. You drink it, you cook in it. You live with it. You open a can of string beans, and the string beans were manufactured in a plant that used water that came out of a tap, and it was probably fluoridated. So all of us are exposed to fluoride, whether we like it or not. But the trick to all of this is how do we survive it? It's just another one of many assaults that our government and industry are making upon our bodies for profit and gain. But what are we going to do about it? You know, a lot of people, they throw up their hands and say, well, there's nothing you can do about it, so just forget it. Oh, no. No, I want to live long enough to die from old age. And if I'm going to die from old age, I'm going to have to do something about that those contrails. So I got to do something about the fluoride. I got to solve this cancer problem. All of these assaults that are being made upon us, you know, there's a solution to it if you put your mind to it. And this fluoride problem is just another one of many. Just like the contrails I've reported on, you know, they're spraying us with toxic chemicals, protozoa, and upper respiratory disease is the outcome. We don't know how many people are dying, but it's in the thousands per year here in the United States, thousands per year from this Title 50 program that's been enacted by Congress. That's another top secret military project. So when you see those contrails up there, they're poisoning you again. That's another secret project that 50 years from now will be reported on, just like this fluoride is being reported on, you know, 50 years after the fact, which is about how long it takes. I remember my granddad used to preach me sermons about those dirty, rotten Germans, about how bad they were. When I grew up, I thought that Japs and Germans were the two worst people God ever put breath into. I'm from World War II, see. And so my granddad told me about how bad the Germans were in World War I, how they had sunk the Lusitania, see. Well, that Lusitania story. Well, the Germans had published in five newspapers that this ship was carrying, it's a British ship, and it would come over to New York, and it'd bring passengers back and forth, you know, from London to New York. And so, you know, on the return trip, they would load up munitions in New York and haul them back to England. Well, the Germans found out about that, and of course, our government denied it. We were a neutral country, so hauling this war material back. And so the Germans had found out about it. They said, they published this in five papers, by the way, coast to coast and border to border. They said, hey, you Americans, stay off that ship, because if we catch it out in the ocean, we're going to sink it. So I thought the Germans were pretty big about it. You know, they said, well, listen, you know, that thing is hauling war material, and you know, that's a belligerent, and we're at war with England, and so, you know, butt out of our fight. And so there was some Americans on it, and they sunk the ship off Ireland and killed, I don't know, 200 or 300 Americans. And that was designed, by the way, to get us involved in World War One, but the Americans didn't buy into it, and so that didn't work until, you know, a couple of years later. Well, listen, in 1967, long after my granddad had died, see, my granddad, he thought that was a neutral ship. You know, he thought, well, the ship wasn't neutral, but he thought that it wasn't carrying armaments. And then come to find out, you know, after he died, 50 years after the fact, 1917 to 1967, you know, 50 years later, oh yeah, it was carrying munitions. Not only was it carrying munitions, it was special caliber munitions that were being manufactured for the British in Fort Wayne, Indiana, by the Americans. So America was involved in the war against Germany long before, you know, we ever got formally involved in 1917. So just tuck that one away in your heart, and now you know a little bit more than you did before. Our government lies to us regularly. The confusing part is, once in a while they tell us the truth, you know, and then they mix the truth with the lies, and that keeps us confused totally all the time. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, now I got to give you one more reminder here. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, at least to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about fluoride. Now, the book that we're reporting on is called The Fluoride Deception. It's written by a guy named Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N. And if you'd like to get a copy, you can call our favorite bookstore in Austin, Texas, They're located at bravenewbookstore.com. So if you want to get them on the web, that's bravenewbookstore.com. Or you can call them. The telephone number is 512-480-2503. That's in Austin, Texas. That's 512-480-2503. If you're down in Austin, Texas, they're at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, 1904 Guadalupe, not too far from the Texas campus of the University of Texas, downtown Austin. And the zip code is 78705. If you're going to write them by snail mail, that's Austin, Texas, 78705, 1904 Guadalupe Street, Brave New Bookstore. All right, we are reviewing a story here written by a guy named Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N, called The Fluoride Deception. Reads like a novel, interesting story, historical novel. It's just filled with all kinds of neat facts and figures, names, dates, times, and places, taken from declassified World War II Manhattan Project documents. It's not all from Manhattan Projects, but there are documents, but a lot of it is. And it's a real expose on the history of fluoride. Here's why you've got the stuff in your drinking water. It's more than just health. It's the history. It tells you where the bodies are buried and the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence that have put this monster in the marketplace. Now, going on, he is stalked too. Now, we're talking about a guy by the name of Arnold Kramish. Now, this fluoride, now, once it gets into your body, it's going to be there for the rest of your life. It's going to screw up your teeth. It's going to screw up your life. It's going to give you symptoms of all kinds of diseases that you'll never suspect have anything to do with fluoride. So, if you're sick and you've got disease, it could be that it's the chemtrails. It could be that you've got aspartame poisoning. If you're taking sugar, you know, the sugar-free stuff, it could be monosodium glutamate. I mean, we've got some poisons that are in our food supply that are just very common. I mean, you know, when you read the label and it says MSG on there, you don't think anything about it. That stuff's another deadly toxin. Tastes real good. You know, if you're looking for taste, you just can't beat MSG. No, it's a toxin that kills you. Those chemtrails overhead, they're killing you. And people are dying. We're estimating about 6,000 a year from the chemtrails. And then, you see, you get this multiple problem. First of all, your body is weakened by fluoride. Then the chemtrails come along and they dump a little bit more poison on here and it tips you over the edge. And you get pneumonia or you get some other disease and you die from it and your death certificate says, oh my God, this guy died from pneumonia. This guy died from muscular dystrophy. This guy died from Parkinson's. This guy had Alzheimer's disease. Yeah, this is, you talk about the perfect murder. You talk about the perfect crime. I'm beginning to wonder were the population control people thinking, you know, during World War II, hey, what a great way to kill millions of people, fluoride in the water. Because this is where it got started. It got started during World War II. They started the experiment in New York State in 1944, putting it in the drinking water. Now, talk about animals over here. And this Phyllis, what was her name, Molesky or something like that, she was absolutely dumbfounded. She said she worked with this guy, Hodge, who had conducted these medical experiments during the war. Now, in Hodge's defense, you know, you got to say, World War II was a traumatic event. And the people involved, you know, in the war and the war effort and the Manhattan Project, you know, they're thinking that the Germans are going to come up with this nuclear weapon before we do. And if they do, they're going to drop these bombs on New York. They're going to be dropping them on Chicago and so on. And so they're in a race with evil. And so you can understand from their point of view, you know, if we have to kill a few people in the process of developing this bomb so that we're first and ahead of the Germans, maybe a few extra bodies, you know, are well worth the price. And the number of bodies, as old Joe Stalin once pointed out, he says, you know, when somebody dies, That's a tragedy. When a million people die, that's a statistic. And I'm sure that these military people and Hodge and these other guys, you know, they're thinking about terms of millions of people dying in a nuclear holocaust. I mean, we saw what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then we're all of us sitting over here wondering, well, what's going to happen when Osama bin Laden finally connects with this bomb, or when the Pakistanis, go radical on us, and they've already got the bomb, and they're just about to do that. So it's coming one of these days to a city near you, but we just don't know when, but all of us are sitting here, you know, biting our nails, saying, well, when's this shoe going to drop? Well, this is the context that's going on in World War II. So I'm not sitting here finding fault, you know, with these guys. What I'm pointing out is the documentation of it. The concepts that we never experiment on innocent people with medical experiments. That's nonsense. We never torture people. Americans are good guys wearing white hats, you know, like Tom Mix and Roy Rogers. That's horse pucky. And you can see that at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. You know that torturing people is a damn lie. And I could have told you that 25 years ago. I've been through the jail system here. In this country, we don't call it torture. We call it pain compliance. They just apply pain to you until you comply. That's called torture. You know, in conventional circles, you know, we used to call it torture. This waterboarding that you hear about, you know, being talked about in the news, that the Bush administration, you know, is justifying. Well, that's called the Chinese water torture. I mean, you know, we use the Chinese water torture on our prisoners over here. Have we done it in World War II? Not that I heard of. World War I, not that I know of. Guys like Sergeant York and Audie Murphy, you know, I think those were real heroes. Americans have always loathed that kind of behavior. It's just been in modern times with the Bush administration. And during World War II, here you see with this fluoride over here that there's been some exceptions made to the rule. It wasn't the rule the way it is today, but it was, you know, the exception. And I reported to you about the medical experiments done in the 30s on the blacks with syphilis. I mean, hell, that's a black eye if I ever saw one. And that went on for about 40 years, started in 1932 or 3 and ended about 1972 or 3. So that was fairly recent. Well, anyway, this guy, Arnold Kremisch over here, he is stalked too by memories of the chemical hell that erupted in South Philadelphia in September of 1944. But Groves kept all of these deaths secret. On the morning of September the 2nd, 1944, 21-year-old Private Kremisch, an engineers, Peter Bragg and Douglas Meigs, reported for duty at the sprawling Philadelphia Navy Yard. The yard housed a super-secret facility using hot liquid fluoride and pressurized steam to enrich uranium for the atomic bomb. Kremisch was one of 10 volunteers who had arrived to train on the new equipment. Just 3 days earlier at the Manhattan Project's vast construction site at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Harvard University President James Conant had gathered them in and asked for volunteers. Conant warned them that their work in Philadelphia would be one of the more dangerous parts of the project, remembers Kremisch. All right, now they're asking for volunteers here. So when you volunteer to go to Iraq for this hazardous duty, and you're doing it for your country, you know, you're taking your life in your hands. James Conant was acutely aware of the dangers the men faced from the fluoride. The chemist was one of President Roosevelt's top atomic advisors. He knew about the DuPont Teflon deaths, and he had seen the secret army reports on fluoride toxicity that General Groves had requested in December of 43. The reports explained that the military was carrying out wartime human experiments with fluoride and fluoride gases at the Army's Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland, searching for chemical warfare agents. The Army had received data about fluoride experiments on humans in England that had produced powerful central nervous system effects. And there were reports from captured prisoners of war suggesting that the Nazis also were investigating fluoride as a war gas. Harvard's president was so disturbed by the extraordinary toxicity of certain fluoride compounds, especially those used in the human experiments, that he issued a secret warning to a senior U.S. scientist about the atomic industrial fluoride work. As an organic chemist, Conant wrote, I think I should point out to you that it is conceivable that similar effects would occur with any fluorinated organic acid, although probably the compounds would be less striking in their action. And it's further conceivable that these compounds could be formed in small amounts by the action of fluorine gas on the acids or related compounds. Now here's an interesting paragraph. We don't know how many people were experimented on. We don't know if it's 10 or 15 or 10 or 1,500. It doesn't say. My guess is that it's probably more like 10 or 15. But I would hope that it's 10 or 15. But hell, it could have been in thousands. We don't know. We do know that the experiment that was used, and I think it was in the name of the city is in here, like Utica, New York or something like that. It was a pretty good sized town. They put fluoride in the drinking water back in World War II. I think it was 1944, in small doses, of course, to test, and they found it was harmless. Well, you know, the people weren't falling over dead walking down the streets, you know, so to their minds, it was harmless. Now, that's a pretty sizable experiment when you take a whole American city. Just one. I mean, it wasn't like they were doing it, you know, to everybody, but they took one American city in New York State and put fluoride in the water, and nobody, you know, they weren't sitting there saying, well, let's talk to you about the pros and cons of it. And they knew that the stuff was a deadly, toxic neurologic gas, a neurologic toxin. Now, when you go out and you start experimenting on a whole city of people over there, what if it had killed all those people? What if it had crippled them? I guess that's a part of the price you pay for the experimentations of war. Maybe somebody up the line, maybe even President Roosevelt said, you know, if 30, 40, 50,000 people have to die or be seriously injured in the process, well, that's the price we have to pay for science. They were certainly willing to take it, and they were willing to take it with you people in New York. Okay, so if you don't think that human experiments go on in this country, I got news for you. And we don't know what the hell they're doing today. What's going on today? We won't know that for another 50 years. But you need to know that human experimentation's been going on in the past. Here's the documented record of it. And it more than likely is going on right now today. And we sure as hell know that these chemtrails up here is a big experiment, some kind of a big military experiment. They're spraying the whole of the world. It isn't just in the United States. I get reports, boys and girls, that come from Australia, South Korea, Japan, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico. Now, I can't tell you about China or Russia. I haven't seen any reports about chemtrails being used there. But it's being used in Europe and England, Ireland. So, in the Western world, and in South America, I can't tell you about Africa now. I don't think I have any reports from Africa or the Middle East. I can't tell you about India. But here in the Western world, North and South America, and in Europe, it's being used. Now, what in the hell are they spraying these protozoa and cancer-causing chemicals by airplanes? And they're spending, boys and girls, billions of dollars. That costs a lot of money to fly those airplanes. And it goes on day after day after day, week after week after week. I mean, this, you know, I live in a little rural area out here in southern Missouri. We're talking about 5 hours to Kansas City, 5 hours to Little Rock, 5 hours to St. Louis. I mean, I'm out in the boonies. 5 hours to Tulsa. I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. And they're spraying us over here at least once a month. And when they do it for several days. And when they do it, there will be 10, 15, 20 of those contrails up there. That costs millions and millions of dollars. Hell, those airplanes burn thousands of gallons of fuel. I mean, in a 747, the center fuel tank is 6,000 gallons, for crying out loud. 6,000, how much is that? $18,000 to fill up the center fuel tank, for crying out loud. And they're burning up that fuel, spreading that stuff around. Now, they're doing that for some reason. Now, tuck that one away in your heart. Getting back here to the story. That fall day at Oak Ridge, however, as he asked for volunteers, Connett did not mention fluoride. All 10 men raised their hands. Any mildly inquisitive guy was not going to opt out, said Kramish. At first, the Philadelphia mission was more Keystone Cops than Cloak and Dagger. When they arrived at the 13th Street train station, a military official in street clothes ordered them into Wanamaker's department store to replace their uniforms with anonymous civilian garb. But the Navy did not give them enough money, and all the men could find were cheap Hawaiian shirts, says Kramish. And he remembers men, 10 men furtively changing into their new outfits in a nearby subway station, emerging into the sunlight wearing brightly colored shirts and GI boots. 2 days later, Kramish, Bragg, and Meggs were at the Navy Yard working on the secret machinery. At lunch, Kramish received a $2 bill in his change. Give it back, his friend told him, warning that it was an omen of bad luck. Kramish pushed the bill into his pocket. Well, that afternoon, back at the plant at 1:20 p.m., a massive explosion suddenly tore at the machinery. Boiling steam and fluoride jetted onto Kramish's legs and back. Clawing at his lungs and eyes, he fell backward, temporarily blinded. A trained scuba diver, Private John Hoffman, ran into the smoking chaos, holding his breath, pulling the injured men from the room and slicing Kramish's clothes from his burned body. This act of bravery would win Hoffman a soldier's medal, although the award was kept secret. I pulled 3 guys out. Everybody was shell-shocked, Hoffman told me. Fluorine gas had gotten loose. It was pretty pungent. I had to watch what the hell I was doing. Well, the afternoon detonation echoed across South Philadelphia. A giant white plume of uranium hexafluoride gas drifted over the dockyard and into the nearby battleship USS Wisconsin. Douglas Meggs and Peter Bragg lay in their death throes. A priest attempted last rites on Kramish, whose wife was told it had been killed. A once-secret report of the disaster makes gruesome reading. 26 men had been exposed to 460 pounds of fluoride and uranium in a huge chemical cloud. Douglas Meggs was sprayed with live steam containing liquid, solid, and gaseous material in large quantities. He died after 16 minutes. Peter Bragg expired an hour later with third-degree burns over most of his body. He seemed in a great deal of pain, the report noted, and became violent shortly before death and resisted all attention. The remaining men survived, although many had serious and slow-healing wounds. Some experienced intense pain in the scrotum, penis, or about the anus, probably because of the hydrolysis of the chemicals in those moist areas. The report notes survivors also suffered unusual nervous system effects. One man was temporarily rendered almost incoherent. This altered mental state was more than could be explained on a purely fear reaction basis, the report said. In all probability, the injurious effects observed on the skin, eye, mucous membranes of upper respiratory tract, esophagus, larynx, and bronchi were all directly caused by the action of the fluoride ion on the exposed tissues, concluded a military doctor. Kramish reports that at a closed wartime inquiry, he learned that part of his suffering had been unnecessary. The head of the Navy project, Dr. Philip H. Abelson, had known how to treat fluoride burns. According to Kramish, but fluoride and uranium were considered so secret that Abelson refused to give the medical facts to the arriving doctors, telling them, "I'm not sure you guys are cleared," Kramish recalls. As a result, he adds, the doctors walked among the injured and dying men that afternoon, guessing what the burns might be. Well, 50 years after the accident, Kramish reports, he cornered Abelson one lunchtime in the Cosmos Club in Washington, and Abelson refused to talk about the accident, Kramish says. It was clearly a trauma for him. Now, the moral to this story is not the few people that got killed here in these experiments, but the ongoing experiment that has been killing thousands of people slowly over a long period of time. These people died suddenly. They were exposed to toxic amounts, and they were poisoned, they died. A couple of 3 of them survived, and they've got war wounds for the rest of their lives. Now, had the doctors known, they could have given these men the activated charcoal, which would have detoxified them, gotten it out of their systems. They didn't do that. And so, in some cases, these guys were doomed to die anyway. I mean, their injuries were that bad. But the moral to the story here is, this is the book that describes the beginning of fluoride. Before they were putting it in your water, they were experimenting with it. This stuff was known to be a deadly, toxic neurotoxin that they were going to use in nerve gas, for crying out loud, to use on the battlefield. Now, you know, if somebody came along today and said, hey, let's start putting Agent Orange into our drinking water. Let's start putting mustard gas poison into our drinking water. What would you think about that? Well, you know, in small quantities like chlorine. You know, chlorine is a deadly toxic gas. And, you know, just in little dribs and drabs. But this chlorine over here doesn't come at no cost. Chlorine causes hardening of the arteries. They call that, they got a name for it. This is an atherosclerosis. Arterial sclerosis, they call it. And we pay for that. And fluoride in the water. Hey, we're paying for that. And they estimate, you know, there's scientists running around over here and they're saying, well, based upon, you know, our laboratory studies and how many rats and mice die when we experiment on them, if we extrapolate that in the same amounts of fluoride that we're using in the drinking water over the same amount of time, over the lifetime of people over here, it's killing this many thousands of people per year. And there's not a single death certificate out there now, boys and girls, that's identifying fluoride now as killing you. You're dying from something else. It goes on your death certificate. But it's the weakened immune system. It's the weakened body condition that is killing you. And it's a god-awful price to pay. God-awful price to pay, in my humble opinion. Now, in the next story, we'll take a look at General Groves. He has this problem. Now, Groves has a solution to this fluoride problem. Wait till we get to the solution in Chapter 5. General Groves' solution is Dr. Harold Hodge and the University of Rochester, New York. This Manhattan Project had seen the danger from fluoride early. And before the war, private industry had contained the legal dangers from factory pollution by forming the Air Hygiene Foundation at the Mellon Institute. And also fearing lawsuits, in 1943, General Groves established the Manhattan Project's medical section at the University of Rochester to strengthen the government's interests, placing Dr. Harold C. Hodge in charge of a secret unit studying fluoride and the other chemicals being used to make the atomic bomb. Now remember, it was the same guy, Hodge, now, that was talking to this Moliner, this Phyllis Moliner, back in the late 1980s. He's an old man now. He knew the answer to the riddle, but he never let on to this Dr. Phyllis Moliner that he knew that it was a deadly toxin. Talk about spooks, huh? Hey, I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Here, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.